Alrighty there, folks, and welcome to the Conacher Podcast channel. Here we have a special guest, the host of the Death of the Roman Republic podcast. So why don't you introduce yourself?
I appreciate it. Hi, I'm a Death of the Roman Republic podcast. My shtick is chronicling the fall of the Roman Republic and the rise of the Roman Empire. Briefly, in some ways, the Roman Republic was in some ways like America, my country, or other representative democracies around the world where leaders had term limits and checked and balanced each other. But over about 100 years, the Republic tore itself apart and transformed into the Roman Empire. Leaders weren't elected. There were no more checks and balances, but Rome was ruled by an emperor whose will was absolute. You might recognize some names like Julius Caesar or Mark Antony or Cleopatra, but there are dozens of other historical figures talked about and the role they played in the death of the Roman Republic. So if you're curious about that process, you can check out Death of the Roman Republic on Apple Pods, Google Pods, Podbean, and more. I also try to integrate contemporary culture and media into the Death of the Roman Republic podcast to connect this 2,000-year-old story. But really excited to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, no worries. And I'll be sure to post links to your podcast once we've recorded this. So yeah, the way that we're going to break this down is it will be basically D-O-T-R-R, talking about what Rome was doing at the same time, and then I'll be doing what the Han Chinese Empire was doing at roughly the same time. So, the floor is yours. Why don't you start?
Yeah, sure. To talk a bit about how this episode even came into being, and again, I really appreciate the opportunity, but from my perspective, you know, hanging out on Twitter, it was actually a Valentine's Day on my end, but I got a DM on Twitter from the Chronicler asking if I wanted to collaborate, and, you know, admittedly, it wasn't necessarily who I hoped might slide into my DMs on Valentine's Day, but it seemed like a very cool opportunity. From my perspective here, we'll be talking about the reign of Augustus, or around the reign of Augustus, and again, comparing that against the Han Chinese around the same time period. Do you want to start talking about population here?
Yeah, of course, go right ahead.
Alrighty, so talking about the Roman Empire's population at the time of Augustus, really at Augustus's death, his Roman Empire had a population of about 45 million people. By the end of the second century, Rome had about 20% of the world's population. And actually, from what I understand, and this was literally in the textbook I read out of, it was very comparable to China at this time, and Han China would have had about 20% of the world's population at the time of Augustus's death. So very comparable.
Yeah.
As far as the city of Rome itself, during this period, the city of Rome was probably the largest city in the known world. It's hard to estimate how many people lived there precisely, but it was the center of the empire that contained nearly 20% of the world's population. Most people say between 1 or 2 million people lived in the city of Rome, which is bigger than some modern U.S. states today, which is pretty impressive. This was not Rome's peak population, but also as the Roman Empire got crappier, the city of Rome's population would shrink well below 1 million inhabitants as well. So not its peak, not its valley.
Yeah, in fact, that is pretty comparable to China's population at the time. From what I've read, China's population at its height of the Han Dynasty was around 60 million. So yeah, it's pretty close. It's around 20% of the population for the world as well. The capital city, Chang'an, this is where it'll be a bit different. Rome certainly was a lot bigger and it held a lot more people than what Chang'an did. From what I gathered, from what I managed to find, the population of Chang'an was around 800,000. So it was smaller than Rome.
I mean, that's still pretty big for, you know, a city before. I mean, you know, cities of those sizes, almost 1 million people. Like, again, there's a lot of U.S. states smaller than that today. So pretty impressive.
Yeah, but really? There's states smaller than 800,000 people?
I had a list of, I didn't mention them all, but Wyoming, for example, in America, I think that might be around 600,000 people living there in the whole state.
Wow, I never knew that. That's crazy, yeah.
Indeed, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, very advanced societies back in the day.
Yeah, definitely. It'd be amazing if they met each other, but we'll get to that later. Okay, so what about...
Indeed.
Yeah, so what about the size then?
Yeah, okay. So as far as the Roman Empire's size, in 25 BCE, the Roman Empire was, hopefully I get this right, 1,060,000 square miles or 2,750,000 square kilometers. For a mental visual here, the Roman Empire, it was comfortably around the Mediterranean Sea. The Roman Empire was Italy and Spain and France and part of Germany. The Balkans, Greece, Western Turkey, the Western Arabian Peninsula, and parts of Northern Africa and Egypt. The Roman Empire would expand slightly in the coming decades and hit its peak population in 117 CE under the reign of Trajan, which is about 100 years after the death of Augustus. That's Rome size.
Yeah. So for the Han Dynasty size, really, the only emperor that we could really thank is the Emperor Han Wu Di, or Emperor Wu. He is the man who really took the Han Dynasty and expanded it even further than any other dynasty had before. So the total size, around the time of Augustus anyway, was around 2,320,000 square miles. In the south, you would have had a warm tropical climate, so that's all the southern provinces of China today. And in the north, you would have had a drier, colder climate, and the deserts of the Tarim Basin in the northwest. And Han Wu Di's invasions saw parts of North Korea conquered by the Chinese at the time. Of course, you've got the mainland China and parts of Mongolia as well.
That's cool. So did it... I'm assuming it did not encompass all of modern China all the way out to the west there. Am I mistaken?
Oh, no, you're correct. Yeah, the Chinese have got this saying, it's like China proper. So it's like the way the Chinese dynasties... kind of like they seen that as the realm of like the civilized, so to speak. And then when the Qing dynasty came thousands of years after the Han, they're the ones who conquered provinces like Xinjiang and Tibet.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. This might be a post-production note. Someone is blowing up fireworks, which is illegal, definitely in my city. But I don't know, maybe appropriate for the Chinese episode. Had they invented gunpowder and fireworks yet around this time period?
No, they hadn't actually. Gunpowder had been invented during the Song Dynasty. So it was a little bit later. But yeah, there's always stories of people using fireworks like way before the Han Dynasty and stuff. And I don't know how they came up with the stories.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Okay, so I guess if the fireworks pick up on the recording, it's a little anachronistic, I guess. But people have to... I'm so sorry. This doesn't normally happen in my neighborhood.
Yeah. Just like, who's setting off fireworks? Those vandals.
Yeah.
All right, okay. So what about religion then? Because from what I can see, the two empires would have had... different religions almost entirely, right?
Yeah, no, I'm definitely assuming so. I'm not going to lie, this is my biggest section, so I hope folks find this interesting. But Rome, like a lot of the Mediterranean world, like Greece at this point, it was a polytheistic society. They worshipped a ton of gods. Famously, the Romans worshipped the Greek gods under different names. Zeus, the Greek god, was worshipped in Rome as Jupiter. And given that the Roman Republic and Roman Empire conquered a lot of peoples, and those peoples had a lot of gods, those gods were easily integrated into the Roman pantheon. Because if you recognize a dozen or so gods, then why not recognize a few dozen more? So religious worship in Rome was done personally and individually, but also by Rome's government. Rituals and sacrifices wanted to divine and gain the gods' favor. This included the observance of flights of birds and animal sacrifice to try to figure out good or bad omens from the gods. The best cows and sheep and pigs were often cleaned and sacrificed as offerings to the god who'd hopefully look upon the Romans favorably. And when it came to government-sanctioned religion, Rome had a variety of cults who were to maintain a good relationship with a particular god, and this was done through rituals. So Rome had a calendar of religious festivals, and they always added new festivals for the new gods they recognized. So for example, the Lupercalia happened every February 15th. Two male goats and a dog would be sacrificed, And then two cult priests would be covered in the sacrificial blood, then wash off in milk-soaked wool, and now the party could really start there. They cleaned up the priests, and then those priests would run through Rome, and they'd be naked except for a goatskin loincloth, and they'd be hitting or whipping Roman women in their path as a blessing of fertility. And if you're thinking, you know, hey, this sounds like Mark Antony's kind of party, if you know anything about him, Mark Antony was definitely one of those priests whipping women for fertility in 44 BCE. Also, fun fact, Lupercalia was also called Dies Februatus, and Februatus is the basis of the name February. So the next time you think about February, you can think of Mark Antony whipping you, wishing you fertility. So have a happy Valentine's Day and around then in the future. Let's see here. If you were a member of a religious cult, it's not as scary as maybe the modern connotation. It could definitely have its benefits and drawbacks. To be a priest or cult member, you were given an important role in maintaining Rome's relationship with the god. And that had a political benefit for a politician. A very young Julius Caesar was nearly a full member of the Flamen Dialis priesthood, and it was really prestigious. That would have been a nice boost to his career. As a priest, Julius Caesar would have lived as a representative of the god Jupiter, Rome's most important god on earth. However, being in the priesthood would have some drawbacks because full priests couldn't travel outside Rome for more than a day, and they couldn't see dead bodies, so Caesar wouldn't have been able to become a Roman general. So history would have been really different if the dictator Sulla had not kicked Julius Caesar out of the priesthood for defying his wishes. It would have been maybe a little more pacifist Caesar, and maybe my series wouldn't have happened, who knows. But Caesar would have eventually become the Pontifex Maximus, the head priest of Rome, which brought a lot of prestige and clout with only minimal drawbacks, besides him getting cuckolded at a religious festival at his own home, but that's a story you can listen to my series for. Religion also had a big role in Roman wars, because if the Romans won a war, it was because it was properly honoring the gods, but if the Romans lost a war, something was obviously amiss. Perhaps a god had been slighted in a misconducted ritual, or perhaps immoral leaders were leading this war. And to talk a bit about Rome's first emperor, Imperator Caesar Divi Filius Augustus, in the role of religion, part of the reason Augustus became the emperor was because he was going to bring peace and prosperity back to the Roman world. Since the murders of the Gracchi brothers and the death of the Roman Republic began, Rome had had a series of civil wars and civil unrest that always resulted in dead Romans, ravaged lands, and opportunity for future conflict, and so some combatants of these civil wars over the decades were Sulla, Marius, Pompey Magnus, Julius Caesar, Brutus and Cassius, Sextus Pompey, Mark Antony and Octavian, and because of all these power struggles, there was just a lot of bloodshed and strife in the dying Roman Republic. But Octavian, now named Augustus, was the final victor, and he had no more rivals to challenge him. So given all of Rome's struggles, Augustus wanted to portray that he was going to make things better. He was a peacemaker. So to show this, early in his 40-year reign, he restored 82 temples to the gods so that Rome might have religious prosperity again. This is a quote from the textbook I use from Dr. David Potter in Ancient Roman New History. The people could be reminded, again, of the fact that past personal immorality had run rampant and the cult of the gods had been ignored, and personal splurges on private luxury had replaced proper expenditure for the common good. So Augustus restoring those temples was going to show everybody that, you know, things are getting back to normal, that I'm restoring our relationship with the gods, and Rome is going to get back on a better track. Augustus himself was also the bona fide son of God, or rather son of a god, because Julius Caesar was named a god after his death. Caesar's will posthumously adopted Octavian, making him his son. And so after Caesar got assassinated, Octavian moved towards Rome to start his political career. He was celebrating Julius Caesar's life at some funeral games, and honoring his victory at Pharsalus, and Caesar's divine ancestor, Venus Genetrix, because Julius Caesar said he was a descendant of the Roman goddess Venus, which sounds insane, but a lot of these aristocratic families had crazy stories about where they came from. But anyways, Octavian, back at these games, saw a comet. A comet appeared in the sky, which normally is a bad omen from the gods, and the people started getting freaked out. But Octavian said that this was a sign that Julius Caesar was a ascending into heaven as a god himself, and that story stuck. So with that, Julius Caesar became a god, and Octavian, then Augustus, became the son of a god, and legitimately, Julius Caesar had statues of him next to other gods in Roman history. Augustus himself, in some ways, was worshipped or nearly worshipped as well. His official policy as emperor that you could make an offering to him and the goddess Roma, who represented Rome, but you could never just worship Augustus as a god by himself. He had to be with Roma. And this was only allowed in the provinces of the empire, where the divine status of rulers was more common, but this was outlawed in Roman Italy. But people across the empire wanted Augustus to have a long and healthy life because his leadership was bringing peace and making things better. Let's see here. Near the end of Caesar Augustus's life, the historian Cassius Dio tells a really insane story, and I don't know if I believe this, but there is a statue of Caesar Augustus, and a bolt of lightning struck out the sea in his name, so the statue read Aesar Augustus. And Aesar is the Etruscan word for god, so implying that he's going to become a god pretty soon. And shortly after Augustus's death, he was also named a god, like Julius Caesar, and Augustus's wife Livia would be named a goddess after her death by her grandson, Emperor Claudius. And I'm not a religious historian, but my last part here, it should at least be mentioned that there was a Jewish population in Rome's territory, and Christianity would start shortly after the Roman Empire was created. So from what I understand, the Jews were pretty consistently mistreated or not treated well by the Romans, possibly most especially by Emperor Hadrian. And Christians would also be persecuted by the Romans, but of course the tides turn as Christianity would one day become the state religion of Rome. So yes, that is my big religion section all wrapped up. What about China's religions?
Yeah, that was actually really interesting, because like the way that you described February, I never knew that. I honestly never knew that that's where that came from. But anyway, yeah, so China's religions. So at the time of the Han Dynasty, and probably pretty much all the way up until the end of the imperial period, Confucianism was the dominant religion or philosophy in the region. And it was again pushed forward by Han Wu Di. So beforehand, like, you need to go back to like the Spring and Autumn era, where all of these great philosophies and religions were kind of springing up. So you had legalism, which basically said all humans are bad and you should try and punish them for their bad ways, and that way they'd stop being bad. That's basically all legalism is. You had Taoism, which is more about keeping in tune with nature and stuff. And then you had Confucianism, and this is about the great sage Kunzi, or Confucius. And Confucius deals with the five great relationships. So he deals with like the emperor to the subject, husband to wife, father to son, brother to brother, and friend to friend. And basically what would happen is there would always be someone who's dominant over the other. So for example, the emperor's dominant over the subject. The husband's dominant over the wife. Sorry, women, but that's the way Confucius viewed it. And yeah, so basically, like, there would be like, everyone would kind of play their role. So like the dominant person would look after the subservient one, and then the subservient one would serve the dominant one. That's the way it would work. And to be fair, it wasn't like medieval Europe where you had like the divine right of kings, where like the emperor could do what he wanted. It wasn't like that. The emperor actually had to be a decent emperor, because if he became a tyrant, what would happen is that the mandate of heaven would be abandoned by the ruling family, and then it would find another family to replace them. So a lot of emperors would try and find the ways of heaven to see signs and try and figure out what was going on. So for example, if there was an earthquake in China, then everyone would say that's heaven heaven's displeased with the ruling family and they're going to be overrun soon. And this kind of happened towards the end of the Han Dynasty. There was a few natural disasters. There was a drought. And then before you know it, like, the authority of the Han Dynasty just started to collapse. And it's all because people believed in the mandate of heaven. It was like a huge thing. But I will mention this as well, because it is important. So during the Han Dynasty, you had Buddhism, which traveled into China through the Silk Road. And eventually, Buddhism would take root in China, and it would stay there. And then, as time progressed, it would be its like the main competitor for Confucianism almost. And even during the Tang Dynasty, like a few hundred years after the Han, there was Tang emperors who celebrated the fact that they found Buddha's finger, or they thought they did. So they would throw a huge party because they thought they found part of Buddha. And some Chinese scholars who were like diehard Confucianist really hated it, and others welcomed it. So yeah, it's one of those things, like the state always had a bit of a problem with Buddhism, or it was like a troubled relationship sometimes. So because Buddhism was a religion, or like Buddhists were a religion, they wouldn't really get taxed. But if the dynasty was going through trouble, they would get taxed, and they would try and like steal the riches of the Buddhist temples and stuff. It's a bit different now. Like, people are kind of free to worship Buddhism if they want to, and there's not really any problem with it whatsoever. So yeah, I thought I'd mention that towards the end here. And that's all I'll say about Chinese religions.
Sure. No, that's interesting. The part where they thought they found the religious relic of Buddha's finger, that's interesting. Yeah. Is that like terribly confirmed in history, or is that kind of just like a shrug, we don't know at all?
No, I think it's confirmed because I really can't remember the guy's name, but this Confucius scholar, the diehard, he disgraced the emperor in front of everyone, in front of the imperial court. But because he held such a high position and he was liked by all of the other Confucian scholars, the emperor couldn't really get rid of him. So there was this like kind of feud between the two of them. And yeah, I don't think it got too ugly, but you could definitely see the conflict and it was written down. So yeah, it happened.
Gotcha. Yeah. That's cool. That's interesting. Yeah. Kind of, all over a finger.
Yeah. Well, that's what the Confucius scholar even said. He went, "Why are you worshipping the finger of a foreigner?" Like, that was his words. And so he's like, "It's a foreigner," because like Buddha's from India. So he's like, "Why are you even worshipping this guy's finger?" So yeah, it was.
That's a great argument.
Yeah. So yeah, just. Those weird this is why I like history so much. It's always these weird arguments that you see prop up anywhere. You're like, I never knew that, and I'm glad I know now.
Indeed, yeah, a lot of fun dark anecdotes.
Yeah. All right, okay, so that's dealt with the religion side of things. What about the armies of the empires? Because like they became massive empires basically because of their military, right? Like they managed to conquer so much land. So Let's dive into that. So what about the Romans then?
A great point. The reason they are gigantic empires is because they had gigantic and successfully ran armies for, obviously at their heights. So Augustus, our first emperor, he really drastically changed what Rome's military had been. And what Rome's military was a giant double-edged sword, because the Roman Republic's armies were almost unstoppable, because apparently by the end of the Roman Republic, the only thing that could defeat a Roman army were the Parthians or another Roman army fighting itself. So by the time Augustus came to power, Roman's armies had been tearing at each other's throats for decades. I mentioned all those people going to civil war, like Sulla, Marius, and Sulla again used their loyal armies to march on the capital of Rome itself and try to violently take control. Julius Caesar, Pompey Magnus used their loyal armies to fight each other. Octavian, Mark Antony, Brutus Cassius, all of them would do the same thing, using their loyal Roman armies to fight each other and getting Romans killed in the process. And a major factor to all this is that Roman soldiers were not paid by the actual Roman Republic government, but the soldiers were just paid by their commanding general. So in all these cases, the soldiers who fought for Sulla, Marius, Caesar, Pompey, Brutus, Cassius, Antony, and Octavian, they were fighting for that man because they expected to be paid. In fact, a legion could be stolen from other commanders with the promise of better pay, because as a teenager, Octavian stole hundreds of soldiers from Antony's ranks because Octavian promised to pay them more. There's also an aspect of personal loyalty. There's stories of near fanaticism of Julius Caesar's 10 legions who served him in Gaul and their utter devotion to Caesar. So particularly great and famous generals like Caesar and Pompey Magnus had several years of service with some of their soldiers and officers, and that loyalty and experience was very, very helpful, especially when it came to fighting other Romans. So Roman armies had become increasingly problematic as a means for generals to gain power and maintain it through violence, and having a well-paid army at the end of the day was essential to winning a civil war. So finally, when Augustus came to power in 27 BCE, those armies were a double-edged sword. Like I said, Augustus's armies had won him this great power, but if someone could turn his armies against him, Augustus would be cut down. So Augustus cut the size of the military in half. Augustus' military would ultimately consist of 28 active legions, which would be about 150,000 soldiers. And additionally, there was about an equal number of auxiliary units to the main region, or to the legions. But the main goal in having the size of the military was to, one, save money, and two, just reduce the possible number of armed soldiers who knew how to kill people that could possibly rise up against him, which is pretty smart. And so in terms of paying soldiers, Augustus was still the one person responsible for paying them and handing out their bonuses, incentivizing loyalty. And given that Augustus is widely considered one of the wealthiest people of all time, with a net worth of $4.63 trillion in modern dollars calculated by Microsoft News, it wasn't likely that someone else could buy a legion's loyalty. To further create peace and reduce instability brought on by numerous soldiers, Augustus would move the 28 legions to the frontiers of the empire. There would no longer be several armies lurking around Italy who, for the right price, would march upon the city of Rome. The legions were out on the frontier looking to protect and expand Roman territory. And if, for example, if a few legions went renegade in Gaul, the Spanish and Germanic legions would not likely join them because they were so far separated. And then those Spanish and Germanic legions could move to engage those treasonous Gallic legions and defend Augustus, the person who's paying them. And then finally, Augustus reformed the Praetorian Guard of the Roman Republic to essentially be his personal army in Roman Italy. It was nearly a legion of 9,000 soldiers who were better paid than the average soldier and whose express purpose was to defend Augustus. And they were the only armed force in Roman Italy, and their loyalty was to Augustus above all else, insulating the Roman Emperor's safety even further. It should be noted that Praetorian guards famously were very bad at protecting Roman emperors in the future and would purposely kill quite a few. But Augustus, who won and maintained power through his loyal legions, would give final bonuses to his legions after his death in his will to ensure their loyalty to his stepson and successor Tiberius. So Augustus always kept in mind that he got power by having loyal armies, he maintained power with loyal armies, and he did a lot to make sure they wouldn't rise up against him.
Yeah, that is actually really clever, right? Because then that way you don't have these problematic legions like lurking around trying to overthrow like the emperor for the highest bidder, basically. I never knew that they were paid by the general. I never knew that. I thought they would be paid from the Senate or something. But I mean,
I know it's such a dumb system, yeah. And it keeps happening to them. Yeah, no, yeah. No one figured out. Let's use the Republic's treasury to pay them. No, it's a great point.
Yeah, just like who was so stupid to say like, oh yeah, we're not going to pay the legions, but the general should, and then the general has this personal loyalty of his soldiers who can then do what he wants with them. Oh, oh, that's so funny.
Right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like kind of a, you know, Rome did not reform very much, very conservative that way. It's like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But their system was definitely broken. That's why I have a series. That's why it was ripped apart, definitely. But yeah, no, it's interesting. How about China, though? Do they have a better system?
Well, yeah, because the central bureaucracy paid the soldiers. So what I want to mention is the Han Dynasty were actually really fortunate in the way that they rose to power, because they succeeded the Qin Dynasty. And the Qin Dynasty put into motion all of these things, like such as you have to serve the army for at least like 5 years, I think they said. And then the Han Dynasty basically inherited this. But what they did is they said, we'll be the good guys and you only have to do 2 years. And it was stuff like that. But yeah, the treasury would pay for everything. They would like pay for the soldiers and things like that. And what I read as well is the Han Dynasty actually made good use of prisoners. So the prisoners would be used for two things. It would either be the labor corps, so they would be the ones who would, like, you know, build the roads for the armies and stuff, or they would be basically, like, suicide squads, and they would just get thrown into the enemy first. So, like, it was kind of like a Russian lorette kind of thing there. So, yeah. In terms of sizes and stuff, the Han Dynasty, at its peak, had a standard army of around, like, 500,000 to 600,000 men. That's what I read anyway. And for example, during the late, like the conquests of Han Wudi, when he threw his army at the Xiongnu to the north, He had an army of 340,000 men with him. So, I mean, that army is huge. And the army would consist of, like, G militia, or G infantry, as well as, like, specialized cavalry. But the way that they would fight the Xiong, it was always, like, open plains in the north. And they had to have huge armies in order to deal with the Xiongnu, who just caused them so many problems. So that's what I've got about that. But after the conquest of Hanwu Di, the treasury was basically empty because he had spent so much money on conquering all this new land. So the Han Chinese kind of went through, it was like a Pax Romana sort of stage, like if you're going to compare it to Rome. And they said, we're not going to keep conquering land because we can't really afford it. So they did the same as what Augustus did. They reduced the size of the army and basically tried to keep it, basically keep them contained within there. And a comparison to like the Chinese generals and stuff, the Chinese generals were actually, it's kind of weird because like in Rome, if you were a glorious general, you'd be celebrated by your men and you could win power. Whereas in China, if you were a really good general, like if you did too well, then the emperor would start to get suspicious of you. And the prime example that I'll look at is a general named Han Xin. So he's the guy who helped the Han Dynasty become the Han Dynasty. He never lost a battle, and he won the empire for the first emperor, Gao Zu, or Liu Bang. And then basically, after Liu Bang won the empire, he felt that Han Xin was a threat to him. So he killed him. And yeah, you're just like, oh, okay, I wasn't expecting that to happen. But you would think he would get rewarded, but no, he sees him as a threat, so he gets rid of him. So yeah, that's what I've kind of got in the army.
Gotcha. Well, gosh, what a brutal, effective system of, keeping yourself safe, but at what cost? You know? Taking down the dude who, made you what you were, yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's such a shame, because, like, Han Xin seemed like he was, like, the same as Liu Bang in the sense that he was a peasant, and he rose through the ranks of, like, the army and stuff, and then, like, he helped Liu Bang basically win the dynasty. And he's like, now you're too powerful. You're too much of a threat. You need to go. And it happens throughout...
Real rags to riches.
Yeah, and it happens throughout all of Chinese history. There was a famous Song Dynasty general, and the same thing happened. Like, he became too successful, so the Song Dynasty got rid of him. And then they were conquered by the Mongols. You're just like, oh, okay. Just like, where's that general? Oh, yeah, he's dead now, because we killed him. So it was like kind of chopping off your own leg.
Yeah, no, exactly. Mm. Yeah. Mm. Interesting pattern there. Your point about prisoners, too, was also very interesting, making them engineers or just having them be fodder on the front lines. Yeah, that's rough.
Yeah, it was pretty brutal, I'm not going to lie. I mean, I suppose that's the difference between the Romans as well, though, because the Roman legions were engineers themselves as well, right? Like, they would build the roads that they used and... all the fortifications and stuff.
Yeah, there was one story of Julius Caesar. He just, like, built a bridge into German territory in a day about, and then, you know, he invaded them and then took it down so they couldn't strike back at him. A lot of great Julius Caesar engineering stories, definitely. But that's a good point. Yeah, they were very good at just constructing their own stuff, yeah.
Yeah. All right, okay. So the next thing we'll move on to then is the buildings, just because, like... you can still see lots of Roman architecture today, so we have to talk about it.
Yeah. So buildings from this period that are still around. So roughly think of it just like, I don't know, 2021 years ago. Like, that's in the middle of Augustus's reign. So some of these buildings have, been standing for 2,000 slightly plus years here. So Roman monuments and buildings that still stand today, known around the world during Augustus's 40-year reign. He was a very prolific builder. Quite a few stand today, like the Theater of Marcellus. Julius Caesar had actually been planning to construct this theater, but then he got, assassinated pretty bad. So the project was uncompleted for many years until Augustus wrapped it up. And years earlier, Augustus's beloved nephew Marcellus had died from a plague in Rome. So that theater was named in his honor, the Theater of Marcellus. And its upper floors are actually apartments today because, buildings get repurposed over time. So that'd be really insane to live in, I would say. Another monument is the Arch of Augustus at Rimini. Rimini is a spot about 210 miles north of Rome, and the arch was constructed at the start of Augustus's reign to celebrate his victories. And the Romans aren't the first people to architecturally use an arch, but they were the first ones to use it to commemorate military victories or triumphs. So these triumphal arches would continue to be erected throughout Roman history and used by non-Romans after the fall of the Roman Empire. But the one at Rimini for Augustus is one of the oldest, if not the oldest, remaining victory arches in the world. And besides, you know, the humble roads and bridges of Rome that are still around, that are still used today, I had one more I wanted to talk about, and I'm sorry if I did not get to your favorite here. But I'm going to end with where Augustus's journey ends, at the Mausoleum of Augustus. Augustus started making his family's mausoleum when he was 30 years old. And aristocratic families constructed big monuments and mausoleums to celebrate their glory, yet the emperor's was going to be way bigger and better than anyone else's. But ironically, a lot of Augustus's family would see the inside of it before he did. And though it still stands today, time had really robbed the mausoleum of its grandeur, because throughout its history, the mausoleum had been looted. It had been shot up by cannons. It was used as a castle, apparently, and for a while was really overgrown with vegetation. But restoration efforts have been happening for a few years now, and literally a few weeks ago, like on March 1st, 2021, it reopened, fully restored. So if you're around Rome, according to the Smithsonian Magazine, you can get into the Mausoleum of Augustus for free until April 21st, 2021, to celebrate the anniversary of Rome's founding on April 21st, 753 BCE. So the trash has been cleared out of the mausoleum, the brick and marbles repaired, among other restorative efforts, and it is also said to have a gift shop worthy of an emperor, and I fully intend to someday go there and waste a lot of money and maybe break down in tears in the Mausoleum of Augustus. But yeah, it's I had to definitely mention that one, just because literally just a couple weeks ago opened up. Like, what kind of timing? It's a shame that, you know, world travel is really shut down. So again, if you're in Rome, I really implore you, take advantage of that and let me know what it was like.
Oh yeah, I never knew that. And Rome has always been my, like, my one dream destination. And I know I was close. I was really close to Rome. And for some reason, I just never went. I've always said I'm going to go, like, and try to plan it, and then I just never went. And now I'm in China. I don't know how that happened. But definitely, I want to go to Rome, because, like what you said, you could see all this architecture. And, like, the mausoleum, I never knew that. I really did not know that. And there's just one more thing. I think I would join you and just cry in the middle of the mausoleum going, oh, look at it. It's so spectacular.
Indeedy, indeedy, yeah.
And I would definitely waste lots of money. I don't care. Like, I would definitely be, like, a fanboy and just spend all my money in the gift shop, even though it's cheap and tacky. Well, expensive and tacky.
When in Rome, yeah.
Exactly. When in Rome, do as the Romans do. So, yeah, I would definitely do that. So, yeah, that's definitely something that I'm going to do. I'm going to speak to the wife after this and tell her that we need to plan to go to Rome next year or something.
Exactly, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so in terms of buildings that are left by the Han Dynasty, I searched and I searched and I searched and I couldn't really find anything to, like, that's left standing. I mean, of course, there will be buildings that are left standing, but the problem is that most Chinese dynasties, like, so Chinese history has always went through this phase. It's like a cycle. So one dynasty rises, and then after a few hundred years, it gets corrupt, and then it falls, and then the way it falls, it's always a civil war. There's never a peaceful transition of power. And from what I can gather, what would have happened is the temples or anything that was built by the Han Dynasty would probably have been destroyed, or it would have been rebuilt by the new dynasty. So the capital, Chang'an, it's not really famous for the Han Dynasty anymore, because the Tang Dynasty made their capital at Chang'an as well. So if you go to Chang'an, which is modern-day Xi'an, you will see lots of Tang Dynasty stuff. So it's almost like the Tang, when they came to power, they built over the Han Dynasty stuff. That's the only way I could describe it. So yeah, that's all you could really say about that. But I will say, if you ever go to China, I would recommend Xi'an, because that's where the Terracotta Warriors are. That's where you would see Qin Shi Huang's tomb. Well, you don't see the tomb itself, but you see where he built it and stuff. And the food there is really good as well, so I would definitely recommend Xi'an if you ever go to China. It's really nice.
Okay.
Because that's all I could really say about the buildings. They were either destroyed or built on top of by new dynasties. That's basically what happened.
Yeah, no, I really want to get to China someday. I think Japan is the first leg of my eventual Asia tour someday. But no, my dad's been to China, and he really, really enjoyed it. So I definitely would like to go there as well someday. And that sounds like an awesome place to check out for old history, archaeology, all that jazz. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. As well as that, they've actually got the old city wall. So like you see the original wall that was built by the Tang Dynasty. So you could like take a bike and go cycle along the wall if you want to.
Awesome.
Yeah, so it's really cool. Right, so the next subject was the government, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so I could imagine the governments would be slightly different. But yeah, why don't you start?
Sure, yeah, this might be another one of my longer, maybe more complex sections, but to talk about it simply here, Rome's government at this time, very oversimplified. Our boy, Imperator Caesar Divifilius Augustus, was the autocratic emperor who ruled Rome. His reign was about 40 years from 27 BCE to 14 CE. So that's the most simplified version, but to describe it in more detail, and this is where it gets more complex, Augustus's official title was not emperor, but princeps. He was considered the first citizen of the Roman Republic. To the Romans at the time, the Roman Republic had not died, and they were not ruled by an autocratic emperor. We can just kind of more call it that in hindsight. But as princeps at this time, Augustus was the Roman Republic's first citizen, and he was going to lead the Republic because he had, after all, brought peace to a chaotic Republic and himself had won multiple civil wars against Brutus and Cassius, against Sextus Pompey, and against Mark Antony. So as princeps, he was entrusted by Rome's people and Rome's Senate with extraordinary powers to lead the Republic, and these two specific powers were Imperium Maius and Tribunicia Potestas. So the way these work, Imperium Maius meant that Augustus outranked anyone in Rome's provinces. During the Roman Republic, an individual governor in a province was basically a temporary dictator, and no one could trump what he wanted. But in Augustus's empire, this was not the case. If Augustus came to your territory, what he wanted dominated what you wanted. So with Imperium Maius, Augustus had the highest authority in every province, and Augustus was also given the power of Tribunicia Potestas, based on the powers of tribunes of the plebs, and tribunes were meant to protect the common Roman people. So by stretching the legal definition of Tribunicia Potestas, Augustus could argue that he was empowered to protect the people, and therefore he could do whatever he wanted to quote-unquote protect the people of Rome and Italy. So it effectively gave him supreme legal authority in Italy as well. So with Tribunicia Potestas giving him the power to rule Italy and Rome, and Imperium Maius giving him power everywhere else in the provinces, the princeps had supreme legal authority above all others anywhere in the empire. And these powers, again, as part of the song and dance of the Republic is not dead, we are not living under an emperor, these powers were not permanent, but the Senate had to give it to Augustus every 5 to 10 years. But they always did. It was more of a ceremony than anything else. They were always going to give Augustus these extraordinary powers back. And even though Augustus didn't know it in 27 BCE at the start of his reign, his rule was never seriously challenged by internal or external threats. But Augustus was careful to be more modest than his adoptive father Julius Caesar, because nearly 20 years earlier, Caesar's ostentatiousness in his unlimited dictatorship got him killed. And while Augustus was similarly ostentatious and had overwhelming auctoritas and greater prestige and accomplishments than any other living politician, and he effectively had an unlimited dictatorship, Augustus was more modest in that he refused many honors offered upon him. And even if he was by far the most decorated, most honored Roman in Rome's history so far, and unlike Julius Caesar, Augustus was more keen to discuss with and be advised by his Senate while overwhelmingly getting his way. So had Augustus been more blatant about his basically unlimited power, it might have inspired the Ides of March 2 Electric Boogaloo edition. But Augustus also had a desire to share his power with family members and close associates. And just one example, Augustus's stepson Tiberius would be given Imperium Maius and Tribunicia Potestas along with Augustus years before the emperor's death. And this helped smooth over the transition of power, because when Augustus died, Tiberius had plenty of experience with both powers and could take over ruling the empire by himself. So While Augustus was not always the most particularly popular politician as a young man, the fact that the young Octavian, as a vicious warlord, he made errors and he deserved bad publicity. We always have to remember that Octavian and Augustus, his authority was derived from the Roman armies he had control of, previously mentioned. So he had gone from having illegal private armies to legally sanctioned armies to now controlling all 28 of the legions of the empire and his personal Praetorian guards. So Augustus had that overwhelming majority of armed forces that no one could hope to challenge. So his rule has been described as a veiled monarchy, and in hindsight, it's easy and accurate to call Augustus a military dictator who achieved and maintained his rule through a loyal army. However, Romans in his day realized they were being dominated by Augustus. You know, he might be the princeps, not emperor, but it's very clear he's the one running the show. But as to not turn the Senate and people against him, like the Senate had turned on Julius Caesar, Augustus did carefully cultivate that public image that he was the servant of the Republic, which had not died, and Augustus had brought peace and stability and followed the laws himself, unlike Caesar, who was more blatant about his power, and so that's why Augustus should stay in power. He brought peace, stability, he followed the laws. So that's the more complex explanation, that Imperator Caesar Divi Filius Augustus was the princeps, effectively Rome's first emperor, and he was given extraordinary powers, and his rule was seen as necessary so that he could keep peace and stability in the Roman world, which had been torn apart for decades by civil war. So it was a really interesting song and dance about how their representative democracy had not died when in fact it had.
Yeah, I've always found that interesting. And, you know, Augustus, he did have to be careful with that, right? Because if he was blatant like his adoptive father, Julius Caesar, he could well have ended up basically following the same path as his adopted father, really, right? So he had to...
Absolutely.
Yeah, so he had to, like, be wary of that. And what I find quite fascinating about Augustus as well is that I'm pretty sure Augustus always got ill, right? He got ill and then he would recover. So a lot of people thought he wouldn't really last long, but then he lasted a lot longer than what he actually did. And even he was surprised by it. Am I not mistaken in that, right?
You're absolutely right. Yeah, that's definitely more niche Roman history, but no, that's a great pull. Like, yeah, throughout his younger life especially, he got sick quite often, whether it was like a chronic disease or battle nerves, because famously it happened before quite a few battles that he fell ill and couldn't actually participate and lead, which was used against him certainly. But he actually had kind of a turning point. Maybe 15-ish years in his reign, and after that he didn't seriously get ill again. But yeah, there were many times that people thought, even as what should be a young, healthy man, that he wasn't going to make it. But ironically, Augustus ended up being Rome's longest reigning emperor and outlived many younger people than him, people in his own family. But it was touch and go there for a while, and had he died early on in the empire, who knows what might have happened from there. Maybe more civil wars, maybe the Republic could have been restored, but no, that's a great point to bring up.
Because I was just thinking about it, and it's interesting that he did take that step-by-step process when considering that he was always wary of the fact that he might die the next day, because he was always getting ill. But yeah, it's fascinating. I really think that's fascinating. So to compare Rome's government to China, it is completely different at the time anyway, like for the time. So China's government was run by the emperor. And again, the person who we have to thank for this highly centralized bureaucracy and authority, it will have to go to Qin Shi Huang. And then when the Qin dynasty died, Liu Bang takes over. And Liu Bang, it's almost like a confederation. It's not really a centralized regime yet. But then the fifth Han Emperor, Han Wudi, is the one who really centralizes power and makes sure that China is run by the emperor, no one else. So it's a highly centralized power base, basically. Whatever the emperor wanted, the emperor got. And as well as that, so like there was a lot of like weird rules in the terms of the Chinese courts and stuff. So, for example, you were not allowed to call the emperor by his name. So you could only call him things like Tianzi, which literally means the son of heaven, or Bixia, which is just like emperor, basically. You could never call him by his name. And as well as that, if you were to go into the imperial court, you were not allowed to wear shoes. You were not allowed a sword or armor. You weren't allowed anything. So you just had to take your shoes off and walk in. And even then, the way you walked, you had to show respect. So you had to like bow your head down as you walk towards the emperor. It's almost like a waddle. So if you ever watch a Chinese like history show, you'll always see like the emperor in the court and the way the ministers waddle towards him. It's because they had to do it to show him respect. As well as that, the emperor, he wasn't just seen as a ruler or like a political ruler, but he was like the father of the realm, which ties in with Confucian thought. And he was a religious leader. So basically, that's everything I could say about the emperor. But as well as that, what I find insane is that the emperor wouldn't have just one wife. I know Augustus really tried to make Romans not cheat on their wives and stuff and only have one wife and be faithful to her. Whereas the Chinese emperors did the complete opposite. They took on many, many wives. And the reason why is basically to expand the size of the family and then they can go and rule over the provinces. So the family would then rule over every single province within the realm. And what's interesting is that they thought it would be a good idea to put all of these women who are competing for the same man into one house. So, like, I mean, don't get me wrong, they had their own sections within the house and it was massive. But they were all grouped together inside this house. And if the emperor had a favourite, which he always did, and she got pregnant, all of the other women would try and kill her or make her have a miscarriage in some way by giving her some weird food that would, like, make her kill the baby and stuff without her realizing it. It was just, it's so crazy that they thought this was a good idea. And the thing is, like, every dynasty made the same mistake. So, like, you'll see, like, there's lots of stories about how a woman's, like, brought down a dynasty. And it's a bit harsh on the women. But, I mean, like, the emperor had this favorite concubine, and then another powerful woman with a powerful family would, like, try and kill her, which would cause a civil war and stuff. It's just absolutely nuts. So, yeah, I suppose that's where, like, the difference really lies. Like, Augustus tried to, you know, be this model where you have one wife and that's it. You don't cheat on your wife. And then the Chinese emperor basically took as many women as he wanted. And there's some stories where the eunuchs who were in charge of the emperor, and the reason why they were eunuchs is because they couldn't sleep with the emperor's wives. So they would, like, run in with, like, basically a hat full of names, and the emperor would just pick a random name and that would be the woman he spent the night with and stuff. So it's just stuff like that. You're like, that's insane.
Yeah, I was gonna ask about that, because if I was not mistaken, you know, eunuchs helped run various dynasties of China, from what I had heard, or I wasn't sure if I was confusing that with, like, Game of Thrones or something like that. But okay, I'm glad you brought that up there. I was also going to ask, because it was, if I'm not mistaken here, much more hereditary in terms of who was ruling China, that they all had to be from the same dynasty, same family, like the Han Dynasty. They were, like, rulers of the same family, same biology, correct?
Yeah. But there were like, you know, like, other branches of other families, like, mingling with the main family, and then they would, like, compete for power. So then this is where trouble comes down later down the line.
Gotcha. That's to draw more comparisons to Rome and the Roman Empire. I realize I talked mostly about Augustus, but Rome's system of having new emperors, like, besides later on having civil wars to decide emperors, like, if there was a peaceful transition of power, honestly, it usually happened via adoption. It wasn't necessarily a straight line of fathers to sons. It did happen from time to time, like, very infamously, like, from Marcus Aurelius. He chose his own biological son, Commodus, and that's what the movie Gladiator is kind of about. But, you know, like I said, Tiberius, the second Roman emperor, was Augustus's stepson. And while they are part of the Julio-Claudian dynasty, you know, it's a big series of just, like, adopting, if the emperor didn't have any, you know, suitable male children, just adopting an able, yeah, capable person that the current emperor trusted to take over after him. So in some ways, you know, that's not the worst way to run an empire necessarily sometimes, but of course that's, you know, often backfired for the Romans as well. But yeah, different ways of doing things there. In China.
Yes. Yeah. So it might.
That seems like the worst bachelorette season ever. But yeah, like, yeah, living in the same house with that.
Yeah, because my wife actually, she watched the show and it was based on a true story. It was like a Qing emperor and what happened. This is one emperor. And the thing is, he was kind of like a good emperor. He wasn't the worst, but he always had problems with his concubines. So he's like trying to run the empire and then the eunuchs would run in and say, oh, one of your concubines is doing something again. So then you've seen him, he was just getting infuriated all the time. He's just like, oh, why does this keep happening? Why are they always fighting? So it's just like, it's just so bizarre that they thought it would be a good idea. I mean, don't get me wrong, like, you have a bigger family so you could run over the empire better, I guess. But, like, to even get the children to grow up was very difficult because all of the concubines were trying to get their son to become the next emperor. So if somebody had a son, he was a very dangerous target. And, like, it happened a lot where, like, sons, like, disappeared or concubines, like, famously, Liu Bong's first wife, like, the founder of the Han Dynasty, his first wife cut up, and I mean literally cut up, his favorite concubine and stuck her in a jar when he died. As soon as he died, like, she had, like, this woman had no protection anymore, and this woman, like, literally cut her up into pieces and displayed her in the court. And you're just like, oh my god.
Yeah, that's grisly.
Yeah.
That kind of reminds me of, this is more off track, but Ptolemaic Egypt, like Cleopatra's family, it's like they kind of have the habit of just marrying each other, which is pretty gross. Mm-hmm. But also, like, that meant, like, every descendant of the royal family had a very good claim to the throne. So if they just killed enough family members, they could be the one single ruler. And that was, like, a big problem in Cleopatra's dynasty. Kind of, like, was that much of an issue? Just like that, you know, with so many kids with royal blood that many could lay claim to a throne and that could start a civil war. Like you did mention, they always did end in civil wars, these dynasties tearing each other down too much, possibly.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like, the Han Dynasty, they were kind of clever about it. They basically, if somebody was like a really good minister who was a member of the family, they would send them to the frontiers. And then that way, they're not really a problem to the central regime. But what happened towards the end of the Han Dynasty, you have powerful ministers and warlords rising up. And the guy who I'll touch on it briefly, his name's Tao Tao, and he's the one who controlled the emperor, and basically he was the one who passed the laws. So he was like the power behind the throne. And eventually it was Tao Tao's son who dethroned the Han Emperor, and then that's when the Han Dynasty collapsed, officially. But I mean, it'd already been going through civil war for like 20 years or something.
Gotcha. Yeah. Interesting stuff. Interesting parallels across all these cultures.
Yeah, it's really cool, right? What we'll touch on now, I think, is probably, like, did they know a lot about each other, like, at this time? So did the Romans actually know about the Chinese at the time?
Yeah, okay, so from what I can tell, and literally all of this comes from YouTube videos I watched, but yes, the Romans and Chinese were aware of each other, but the governments did not officially interact. There wasn't like a Roman embassy in China. There wasn't a Chinese embassy in Rome, anything like that. Augustus definitely met with some people from India who could have maybe described a bit of China to him. But in general, the reason they knew each other is because traders from the aforementioned Silk Road, they traveled Asia and bits of Africa and Europe, and they would have traded stories about the faraway empires. And given how word of mouth this was, you know, the Romans didn't have that much accurate information about the Chinese, and the Chinese didn't have that much accurate information about Rome, but they knew that there were these big empires on the opposite end of the world from each other, and that they were somewhat comparable in size, at least.
Yeah, that's basically what I've got as well. So I am going to say most of my reference comes from the Kings and Generals channel, where they talk about if the two empires knew each other. So from what I've seen, In a battle with the Xiongnu, like to the north, where they were always fighting, like the Han Dynasty, the grand historian of the Han Dynasty, Sima Qian, said that the Han army didn't only encounter horse archers, as was the norm, but a disciplined infantry formation with a fish scale formation. So that's the way he described it. It was a fish scale formation. And some scholars have speculated that this would have been a lost Roman legionary in this fish scale formation, which was the famous Testudo. And who knows, maybe that was a bit of contact there already. But I mean, again, like the Han army won the battle and they never seen any fish scale formations again. So who knows? Like, we have no idea. As well as that, like, in terms of...
I actually might have seen something similar to that. Yeah, I think I saw something about that. But there's, I mean, in terms of a lost legion, so around 50 BCE, there was a Roman general, Marcus Licinius Crassus. He fought the Parthians. He lost very badly. Some of them, you know, there were some prisoners of war, possibly. Mark Antony went in, lost very badly, and there were some prisoners there. So I saw some speculation that's like those prisoners, they might have escaped, gone east, and then that is how that possible fish scale formation or Tetudo formation would have happened. So I think that, like, that is that is how that quote unquote lost legion possibly got out there, if that was accurately them. But yeah, sorry to interject there, but I think I did see something about that. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I know, that's fine. You don't need to apologize, because yeah, you explained it very well there. Because like, yeah, from what I heard, they were prisoners, and then they got put east. And then they escaped from that eastern outpost in the empire, and they traveled, and then they acted as mercenaries for the Xiongnu against the Han dynasty. So that's one contact where we don't really know, because like there was no survivors of the battle to testify it or anything like that. As well as that, there was an official mission sent to discover the Roman Empire by the Han Chinese. And this happened a bit later after the time frame that we've been talking about, so like Augustus and Han Wu Di. The Han dynasty went through basically like an interregnum period where a powerful minister deposed the emperor and created what was called the Xin dynasty. But after that, he died, and then the Han dynasty restored itself, and you have the Western Han, and now we're into the Eastern Han period. So it's a bit later. As well as that, the western provinces during this short Xin dynasty in the Tarim Basin, they went up in rebellion against this new dynasty. And then when the Han came back, it took a few years for them to reconquer this area. And when they did reconquer this area, there was reports coming in about this really powerful empire to the west, and like to the really far west. And the ministers at the time, they were kind of shocked. They were like, really? There's another powerful empire out there? And then the reports would say, yeah, and they're probably just as powerful, if not more powerful than you. And they're like, obviously, that like the arrogant Han ministers who think, you know, China's the center of the universe. They'd be like, our great Han? No chance. Not a chance. But anyway, they were curious about this. And they were like, okay, well, let's look into this. And to really bring the point home, the reports like came in, and they were saying that this new, like, this empire, the people in it, they would wear long garments and fine garments and that. They would cut their hair and, you know, look presentable. And they would basically, like, say that these people were honest. And I don't know why they would say the Romans were honest. I mean, maybe in terms of foreign treaties they were honest, but inside the Senate, I don't think there would be an honest politician there. And the Han Chinese, like, through seeing these reports, were basically thinking, well, this is very similar to us. And some of them even viewed it as, like, a mirror. So, like, in Taoism, like, a lot of things are, like, reflected through nature. So, for example, heaven has a bureaucracy and a central regime with an emperor. Therefore, that's why the Han dynasty's got an emperor with a central bureaucracy. That's the way they thought. So they just thought it was a mirror of their own greatness far to the other side of the world. That's the way they viewed it. And in 97 AD, the protector of the West, like in the Tarim Basin, his name is Ban Chao, and he sent one of his subordinates named Gan Yin to the West in order to find the Romans, or what they called the Romans, which was Da Qin. And the Chinese didn't really see the Romans as a threat. I mean, it makes sense, because they're at the other side of the world. They can't send an army there. Or maybe they could, but it would take a long time to get there. But what they seen was a valuable trading partner, because they knew their silk was going somewhere. Somebody wanted their silk. And, like, silk's expensive. So they know there's a powerful empire out there. They just need to find it. So as well as that, like, they were hoping to establish maybe a trade deal and maybe a potential ally. So Ganying in 97 AD, he set out with his small entourage and he travelled across the Parthian Empire. And it is here where he reached the northern edge of the Persian Gulf. And this is where things kind of go badly for the Chinese entourage, just because they're speaking Chinese, the Persians are speaking all these different languages, there's Egyptians there, they're speaking different languages. Nobody can translate what the Chinese are saying, and they're just saying Dachin, like trying to find the Romans. And eventually, these sailors say, okay, we'll take you around the Persian Gulf and we'll get you to Egypt. But the problem is, if the weather is bad, it will take 2 years to get there. So, with that, Gan Yin just said, nope, that's it. We can't find the place. We've had enough. And then they set off home. And like the funny thing is, if they traveled like northwest a little bit, they would have reached the city of Antioch within like 40 days. And it's quite crazy to imagine. Could you imagine if like he made it to the Roman Empire and they established contact? Like what would you think would have happened? Like if we're going to go like in the speculation sector here. So what do you think would have happened if they actually met each other officially?
Yeah, well, you know, Romans love a good conquest, I guess, in some ways. Like, I had actually a bit more to add on there, that it's like, you know, the Chinese, I also came across, this is from the YouTube channel, History Matters, in their video, Did Ancient Rome and China Know Each Other? And it was this great 3-minute little history there. But they mentioned in that video that, yeah, the Chinese referred to Rome as Da Qin, which they said translated to Great China, but again, kind of seeing it as its equal, that just happens to be on the opposite side of the world. The Romans, what they called the Chinese was Serica, apparently, but the Romans were also famously pretty xenophobic, upturned their nose at barbarians and non-Romans. They didn't have a high perception of Serica, what they knew about the Chinese. So my guess is that they probably wouldn't, you know, that just might be, inspired them to go out conquesting, kind of like, you know, trying to recreate Alexander the Great's empire, only better conquering out into China or something like that. I think I also saw in some video it speculated that the Parthians or Persians or whichever empire at the time was in between them actually had an interest in keeping them apart because they wouldn't ever want the Chinese and Romans teaming up to attack them on both sides or anything like that as well. That would be interesting. Honestly, my gut reaction is that if the Romans knew the Chinese definitely existed, they would want to conquer it, but would never be able to because, you know, the Roman Empire, it didn't get much bigger than it was at, you know, the start of the Roman Empire. It was really expensive, obviously, to maintain something that big, and that would have been a really big, expensive war to get out to China. They would have to conquer the Parthians, which they failed to do twice, definitely, or the Persians, if it's in the in-between time there. Yeah. But yes, that would be a real pipe dream for them to conquer, I think, from the Roman perspective. But what do you think, I don't know, the Chinese being a little more respectful of the Romans, do you think they would try to open up economic ties more?
I think so, because that was the nature of the mission. Like, they did try to establish like an official trade agreement, so I think so. But I mean, like what you said, what probably would have happened is that relations would break down because the two see themselves as the best in the world, and then therefore they would probably have a fight. And it would be interesting to see who would actually win that war. If there was to ever be a war, it would be like, I don't know who would win. I really don't. Just because the Romans, like, I think the Roman legions were better in terms of like the fact that they were more experienced at fighting all the time. And they certainly, the Romans were able to adapt to any kind of situation really well. Whereas the Chinese, they were just used to fighting the Xiongnu, mostly, you know? So I don't really know if, like, the Chinese would have won if they were to ever fight that war. Like, I really don't know. It'd be interesting to see. I think the only way the Chinese maybe could win is just, like, through sheer force of numbers. If the Romans were to send an expeditionary force, that is.
That's, you know, that's really fair. That'd be, I mean, a cool battle simulator. It's like, take the 10 best Roman generals of all time. They all work together on one side, the 10 best Chinese generals on one side, and they all work together magically, you know, very hypothetical situation. And then, and I don't know, give them equal numbers of troops and then fight one battle on Roman turf and one battle on Chinese turf. And then if there needs to be a tie break, I don't know, there's a tiebreak somewhere, but yeah, no, that's some real interesting speculation. Like, what could they have done to each other fighting at their hypothetical heights and stuff like that? Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. But I mean, from what I can gather, the Chinese, they were going there just to establish a better trade route and maybe seek an alliance. And then if the Romans seen that and actually seen an alliance, that would be interesting as well. Just because, like you said, the Parthians, they would be surrounded almost. It'd be like a giant pincer moving in. So who knows what would have happened if they managed to establish contact.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Make them sweat a bit, yeah.
Yeah, so is there anything else you want to add, or is that everything then?
I think that's about all of it, dude. Yeah, yeah. No, I'm tapped out, I think.
Yeah, same. I need to go for a long walk after this. Yeah, well, I mean, it was great having you, man. It was a really interesting topic, and you know, we could maybe do it again sometime with two other subjects. Who knows?
Yeah. No, this was awesome, dude. Yeah. This is only my second type of interview thing. But no, I appreciate that. Just being in the podcasting space, you meet very interesting people across across the world, frankly.
Yeah, definitely.
So I really appreciate the opportunity getting to be here.
Yeah.
This was fun.
Yeah, it was really fun. And I must admit, I did enjoy like reading the notes that you had, and then I could like compare them with like my notes and stuff. And like, I really enjoyed looking at this topic. It was so much fun. And I'm glad that you agreed to my proposal and we did this. It was really fun.
Yeah, no, and this is totally, if I didn't emphasize this enough already, this was your idea, comparing these two powers. Like, I think I threw out crappier ideas, certainly, but no, this is a great idea. So again, really appreciate the opportunity. Yeah,
no problem. Well, thank you very much, and we'll all see you next time on the Chronicled Podcast channel. So thanks for listening.